Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
My brother loaned me $85,000, and I couldn't lose my brother's money. So I was in my office, this little office we had. I put two chairs together. I laid down, and I just said, please, I promise that I will be a good employer. I'll share my profits with my employees. I'll always do right by my customers. Just please help me not lose this money.
From NPR, it's How I Built This, a show about innovators, entrepreneurs, idealists, and the stories behind the movements they built. I'm Guy Raz, and on the show today, how Carla Bartolucci rediscovered a prehistoric grain, turned it into flour and pasta, and launched a powerhouse organic brand, Jovial Foods. A lot of people ask us how we choose the stories we tell on the show. And the simple answer is a lot of searching. We spend a lot of time researching founders and their brands. But every once in a while, an idea grows from something we come across in our daily lives. And about a year ago, in the supermarket, I noticed a box of gluten-free spaghetti made from cassava flour. I was intrigued, so I bought it, and it was pretty great. The brand was called Jovial, and I'd already been using their diced tomatoes and rice pastas in my cooking for a few years. They make olive oil and tomato paste and even cookies, all produced in Italy. But the brand is probably best known for its pastas made from a wheat called einkorn. And because I'm a sucker for stories on boxes, I read about how Jovial helped revive this ancient, unhybridized wheat, a type of wheat that is not genetically modified, so some people with gluten sensitivities can actually eat it. Anyway, I decided to dig around to find out more about the brand, and I came across the story of Carla Bartolucci. Carla and her husband Rodolfo grew Jovial from a shaky startup into a national multi-million dollar brand over the past decade. They were inspired by their own daughter who had a sensitivity to wheat and gluten. But the journey to building Jovial was filled with personal tragedy, failures, bad business partners, and very slow growth. So I called up Carla, and we ended up having a wonderful, rich conversation about her life, about her working-class upbringing in Connecticut, and most importantly, about our mutual love of cooking. In the weeks after the interview, we stayed in close touch. Carla sent me her einkorn sourdough starter. I sent her photos of my einkorn flour pizzas. And then, a few weeks ago, I received a small bottle of balsamic vinegar from Modena. She wrote, "This balsamic comes from one of the oldest vinegar makers in Modena. Enjoy this black gold," which I did. And then, a few days ago, I got a call that left me stunned. After a very brief illness, Carla Bartolucci died, unexpectedly, at the age of 53. Even though we never met face-to-face, it still felt like losing a good friend. And while Carla wasn't a household name, she was well-known in the specialty food business and widely respected for her vision and integrity. So while there are a lot of important business lessons to learn from this episode, we want to think of it mostly as a tribute to her remarkable life and career. A life that began in New London, Connecticut, where Carla grew up, the granddaughter of four Italian immigrants.
Food was really important to my family. Both my mother and father were really, really good cooks. My mother, she was just effortless in the kitchen. I never can remember one bad meal, maybe one, but she would also make vegetables really good. She knew how to clean artichokes and cook them with parsley and garlic and a little white wine so that when you ate them, they just melted in your mouth.
Yeah.
So as a kid, I would just walk by this huge bowl of artichokes and just plop them in my mouth. They were so good. She made fresh ravioli, gnocchi, tagliatelle with all kinds of sauces. And, you know, my dad, he was a great cook too. He didn't cook that often, but he would make cabbage and bean soup. Hmm. I'd never be able to, I've tried. I can't replicate the flavor. Hmm. And, you know, my dad, he loved fishing. So he had a lobster boat and lobster pots, and we had a ping pong table in our basement, and I still remember that ping pong table being lined with trays of lobsters, stuffed lobsters that they would cook for our relatives.
Wow.
And he also made wine in our cellar. We made wine, and it was nice, you know. But at the same time, I was growing up in America. And so I think when my grandparents immigrated, they didn't want to be Italian. They wanted to be American. So they tried to lose their accent, but they held on to these food traditions.
Where you grew up in Connecticut, was it Italian? Was it Irish? Was it, like most people, kind of WASPy? Like, what do you remember about the people in your town?
I mean, there was basically in Italy, people would choose a town that was similar to where they came from.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people there came from this one area of Fano, it's called. And they actually developed a neighborhood that was called the Fort. And on the other side of the town was kind of the nice beachy area where more wealthy people lived.
Yeah.
And my father was able to buy a piece of land on the nice side of town and build a house for us. So I grew up in a neighborhood with people, you know, who were better off than us.
So tell me about what your dad did for a living.
He was a bricklayer.
Did he have like a small business that he ran?
He tried. I mean, he really wanted to own his own business, but he had four children, and so he ended up just working for construction companies.
So your dad was a bricklayer, and you had three siblings, other siblings. Mm-hmm. Were you the youngest, by the way?
I was the youngest.
And were you the only girl?
I was the only girl.
Oh, so you were surrounded by boys.
Yeah, so I was very competitive at a young age because I just felt this pressure, like, to do good, just to do things that they were doing.
Yeah. All right. So you're growing up in Connecticut. And from what I understand, when you were 16, your father was diagnosed with cancer.
Yes. My parents sat us down in the living room and told us. And the next day I was in high school. I went to English class. And my friend's father owned the funeral home in town. And I said, you know, Eileen, my father has cancer. Is that bad? I didn't even know what it was. And she just looked at me like, yeah, very bad. And so that weekend, I asked my mom to drive me to the health food store. It was this little teeny health food store I'd never been in, but I saw it when we were driving past it to go to the supermarket. And I walked in and, you know, it smelled like falafel mix and was kind of weird, you know, with all the bulk bins. And I went to the section where they had books and I noticed the macrobiotic, I think that at that time it was called Cure for Cancer. It was a long time ago. And I asked my mom to buy it. And then I came home and I was like, Dad, I'm going to cure you of cancer. I'm going to cook. And he just was not interested.
How old was your dad when he was diagnosed?
He was 56.
Wow.
But he had been to Italy to reconnect with these relatives on his own once, and his final wish was to go back there. So he was very, very sick, but he took one of my brothers and I, and we were there for a month.
He wanted to go to Italy knowing that he did not have a long time to live.
No, he died a few months later. He was also a little sick there. But the trip was amazing. That trip completely changed my life.
And this was your first time going?
Yes. Yeah. You know, we stayed with relatives. They gave us an apartment to live in right in front of the gelato store. And first of all, I noticed just how good people looked. You know, it was a time in Italy before things got big.
This was in the early 80s?
85.
Right.
And I also noticed that when we got to this apartment, like, I was obsessed with, like, turning over forks and looking at the tablecloths, and everything in the house was made in Italy. And I was like, wow, this country sustains itself. Because back in Connecticut, everything was getting, like, huge supermarkets and this little downtown that we had with a butcher shop and a fish market and everything was all closing down.
Yeah.
And then I had this one memory of, it's called the Night of San Lorenzo, when there's a lot of shooting stars. So we went up into the hills. You could see the Adriatic coast. And then we just sat there and the sky was so clear and there were shooting stars everywhere. And I just said, I wish I could live here someday.
Wow.
You know, I was totally hooked. I was thinking, yeah. Why did my grandparents leave?
Leave
this
yeah.
is paradise. Yeah.
So that trip clearly had a huge impact on you. And I guess when you went to college, you went to Connecticut College.
I went to Connecticut College because I wanted to stay close to home because I didn't know if my father was going to be alive or not.
Yeah.
So that's where I went.
And your dad passed away pretty soon after that trip.
He did, a couple days before I actually started college.
Wow.
And it got to the point where you had to decide your major. So I was looking through the book and I said, let me look at Italian. And it said, if you majored in Italian and you have financial aid, you have to spend a year abroad in Italy. And the program covers like your apartment. It gives you a stipend.
Wow.
And I was like, that's
yeah,
me. I'm
that's
going
me.
To Italy.
I have to go to yeah. Italy. I've
yes.
got to go.
It's calling me.
So you end up spending your junior year abroad in Italy, and that year would go to like change the rest of your life, because that year you also met the man who would eventually become your husband and business partner, Rodolfo. How did you meet?
Yeah, he was a friend of one of these distant relatives that I had that lived in Modena, and he said, oh, let's, my mother said, you know, I should come and pick you up and take you to her house so you can say hi to her. So we went to his house, and my husband had just pulled up because his best friend lived next door.
He wasn't your husband yet. He was this guy.
No,
so yeah.
Rodolfo.
Yeah.
As soon as I saw him, I was like, if I'm pretty enough for you, you're my man. I just knew it. He was just, I don't know, just had this feeling.
And you hit it off right away?
We were just friends. I mean, I would go in Italy when you're that age, you have like this group of friends and they all go out together. So on Friday or Saturday nights, they would say, hey, do you want to come to Modena and go out with us? So the girls would sit on one side of the table, the guys would sit on the other, and they would just talk all night long. And I'd get bored. You know, they were talking about things like, oh, have you ever heard of like band roll? They have these roll-ons now that work as deodorant. I was like, oh my God. But they would always sit me next to him because he didn't have a girlfriend.
Hmm. Was he a student?
He actually had just finished military service, and he had previously studied agriculture in Bologna, but his family had had some financial hardships, so he had to go to work.
Hmm. So I guess you two start dating, and at a certain point, you go back to the U.S. to finish college, but then you return to Italy, and you and Rodolfo move in together, right?
Yes.
And what were you both doing?
He was working in this agricultural company, and I had my first and only job as a translator. But after a couple of months, I got yelled at because I translated stainless steel to inoxidizable steel.
Oh.
And I think it was an important company customer. So the man who ran the place took me in his office and just yelled at me. And I just looked at him and I said, I quit. You know, so I've only had one job in my life, and it was like 2 months. And we were already having a hard time making ends meet because in Italy, you know, people don't really make a lot of money.
Yeah.
And if your parents don't have something, it's almost impossible to get ahead. And I didn't want to be like my parents, always worrying about money. I wanted to have a family. I wanted to do things. So I was very motivated to get ahead.
You wanted to start a business.
I did. And so I convinced my husband to go to the United States, because one day I was like, God, you can open a business in the United States for like $200. Hmm. And he said, okay.
Wow. So you convinced him. And by the way, did he speak any English?
No, he studied German in high school.
So he knew no English. You convince him, Rodolfo, you convince him to go to the U.S. And you're not married at this point, right?
No, but we did have to get married for him to get a green card.
Okay, I got you. Right.
We just, like, called my cousin was, like, a justice of the peace, and we signed the papers, and that was it.
Got it. All right. So you get married to come back to the U.S., and now what was the idea? What was the business you were going to do?
The first business idea was to move to Miami and open a Piadina hut at the beach. Hmm. So Piadina is, like, this flatbread that they make on the Adriatic coast, and they have these striped huts, and you know, you just stuff them with prosciutto or cheese or greens or tomatoes. And that was our idea. So we drove to southern Florida, and we actually stayed in a campground in a tent, and it was very frustrating because nobody was going to give you the permit to open up a Piadina hut in Miami Beach. And so one night I went to bed and I left my sneakers outside of the tent. And when I woke up in the morning, I put them on with no socks. And there were these little teeny fire ants inside the sneakers. And they bit my feet. And it was so painful. I looked at my husband. I started to cry. And I said, let's go back to Connecticut. I can't take it anymore.
All right. And so you go back to Connecticut. And did you go back to New London where you grew up?
We live with my parents. I didn't have any – with my mother. I didn't have any money.
Right.
So we were in the kitchen brainstorming, and my brother and his friend were there. And I said, we're going to open a fresh pasta shop with, like, prepared sauces in this touristy town called Mystic, Connecticut. And they were like, you'll never make it. You need to make sandwiches and grinders and things like that. So
right, because Connecticut.
Yeah. So I was like, all right. So we found this man who made this really good Italian bread. It was like 20 minutes away. And so we would leave our house at like 5 a.m, pick up this whole load of bread. And then I would weave in some Italian things. So like I made focaccia, I made spinach pie. And we found an empty store, and it was only $500 a month. We couldn't really afford a sign or anything. So I actually painted the windows backwards in red paint.
And this was in like the late 80s, right?
I think it was 91.
Oh, wow. So if I have my cinematic history correct, this is after Mystic Pizza, the movie, came out.
Probably. We didn't get many tourists, though. It was pretty much a local spot.
I got you.
And we also, my brother had loaned us $5,000. And we took $1,500 of that and bought this old Faema cappuccino machine. So we were the first people in town to have a cappuccino machine. And, you know, my husband was a pretty good looking guy who could barely speak a word of English. So I think people like to come and just for the novelty of getting a cappuccino from a real Italian.
Yeah.
And then on Saturday, you could special order, you know, fresh tortelloni, tagliatelle, all kinds of sauces.
Wow.
You can get homemade lasagna.
And who was making all this stuff?
Me and my husband. My mother helped us, too.
So you guys were just, like, working like crazy.
We were.
Yeah. But it was fun?
Retail's not my thing. I knew that right away. You know, I don't really like to be everybody's friend or talk to people. I'm kind of like a behind-the-scenes type of person. So after a year, we decided to put the business up for sale. We just wanted to move back to Italy. My husband always wanted to own a farm or something. And we sold the business for about, I think it was like $25,000. And we had saved money because we were living with our parents. And so we took all of that money and moved back to Italy. And our idea was to buy a little piece of land and put up a greenhouse and open a nursery.
From what I understand, around that time you went back, Rodolfo's brother was paralyzed. He was in a car accident. And then like around that time, your mom was diagnosed with cancer as well.
We were trying to get something started. And one afternoon, it was summertime, and we were all getting ready to go to the beach. And the phone rang.
This is in Italy?
Yeah, the phone rang. And it was like the hospital. And they said that his brother had had a serious accident and was being LifeStar helicoptered to the Bologna hospital to get there right away. So we took all of our money, basically, and helped his family renovate a bathroom and a little room in his house that was handicap accessible. And then once things started to get better with his health, I got a call. It was my mother, and she said, I have cancer. And I said to my husband, I just can't. I have to go back. So he came with me.
Wow. All right. So you guys are back and forth, and now back in Connecticut mm-hmm. again. Your mom, presumably you don't know how long she has to live at that point.
She had multiple myeloma, so she was sick for about 4 years. It's a lot of cancer going away, cancer coming back. I mean, it just tore me apart. It was terrible.
Did you guys go back and move in with her?
We did. We took care of her and started to kind of brainstorm what was our next move. And she really latched onto my husband. She loved him. It was like, Carla, who? Like, I don't, you know, and so they were always together. And I started to do Italian lessons because we didn't have any money. And one of the women I taught, I became really close with. She was an older woman and she had just lost her son to brain cancer. And so we connected and she told me when I told her I was trying to help my mother with diet, and she said, you should go check out Bread and Circus in Providence. I was like, what's that? You know?
And Bread and Circus was a natural food store that we should just say eventually was bought out by Whole Foods. But at the time it was like in New England, Boston and I guess Providence. And it was like, it was an amazing store.
Yes, it was. And you know, at that time, my husband moves to America. You know, when he grew up, the bakery where his parents bought bread was owned by Luciano Pavarotti's father. He still talks about how good these little French rolls were there. And he comes to the United States, and it's when everything is becoming fake. You know, so we would go to the supermarket and buy a loaf of French bread, and he would just look at the ingredients and say, God, why can't they just make bread with flour and water? I mean, what is dough conditioner and all this other stuff?
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, you're right, you know? And one day we drive to Bread and Circus, and I walked in there, and I immediately went to the customer service and they had a little pamphlet with their financial statement. And I was like, this is where the food needs to go. I mean, America needs to be natural. It doesn't have to be, you know, hippie natural, but we can't keep eating all these additives. And so that's really what I wanted to do. And I was like, this is it. I'm getting into this industry. And, you know, naturally we gravitated toward the pasta aisle. And at the time, I think whole wheat pasta was basically like, if you wanted to be healthy, you ate whole wheat pasta.
Like that was what people gravitated towards. They thought whole wheat pasta was healthier.
Yeah, gluten-free came out way later, but they thought, you know. And so we bought some whole wheat pasta. I think DeBoles was the number one brand. And when I tasted it, I was like, oh my God, we can do so much.
A little
right? We can do so much better than this.
Yeah. But Carla, like you were, I say this with all due respect, you were like, you know, barely out of college with no money and like no resources. How are you going to get into a place like Bread and Circus?
Well, first of all, I have to say that my father was always incredibly proud of me. And he made me feel like I could do anything in life. So I grew up with this confidence, like I could do anything. Right. My husband isn't really like that. You know, it was me. And second of all, my husband really, really missed his hometown. I mean, moving to Connecticut was tough for him. So to make him feel better, sometimes we used to drive to New Haven where they had a newsstand that sold Italian newspapers and magazines. And he would load up.
It was an international newsstand.
Yes. And so we opened the magazine and there was an advertisement for an organic brand of pasta and olive oil and tomatoes and things like that. So we called his father and said, go in Italy, you have to write who is the co-packer. So we said, go to the store and figure out where they make this product.
It was just an advertisement, but what was it about the ad that struck you as interesting?
I didn't even know that there were people in Europe making organic foods.
Okay, it was organic. I got you. It was organic pasta. And you thought, oh, this is interesting. Maybe we should check this out.
Yeah. So we had his father go. He bought a bottle of olive oil. He gave us the address. And we made up a fax and lied that we were a food distributor and that we wanted to sell the products.
So you send a fax to this company and you say, hey, we want to distribute this in the U.S. And they were like, sure, no due diligence or nothing. They were just like, yeah, okay, fine.
Yeah, and they said that they had just developed this brand called BioNature, and they were thrilled to sell in the United States. And then we became friends with them afterwards.
And you were going to just get all this raw material and then package it under your own brand and label?
No, they packaged everything under their brand.
They packaged it.
Yeah.
How much did you order?
Our first order, I believe it was about $20,000. It was a 20-foot container.
Wow. How did you pay for it? Because you guys, you and Rodolfo had no money.
We had no money, but my brother had saved a lot of money working as a bricklayer, and he was just tired of his life. And I said, I have an idea. If you loan me some money, you can have a third of the company. And eventually when we make enough money, I can hire you and you can manage our warehouse.
Your brother was a bricklayer, just like your dad. He was just saving his money.
He saved every penny. He still saves every penny. I don't think he turns his heat on in his house. He's very frugal.
Wow.
Yeah.
How much did your brother loan you?
My brother loaned me $85,000.
Which was his life savings, I have to imagine.
Almost all of it, yeah. And we took $65,000 mortgage on my parents' house.
That's a lot of risk. I mean, you took a mortgage out on the house that basically was the only asset you guys had, right?
Yeah, but I never really thought I would lose the money. I was just, this is going to work. I don't know. I never thought I wouldn't succeed. I think I can do anything.
That's awesome. All right, so that was the money just for this new business, this importing business that was going to sell organic pastas and sauces in the U.S. So you make the order, and the shipment presumably arrives a couple weeks or months later, and you've got tens of thousands of dollars worth of product. By the way, where did you go and pick it up at, like, I don't know, Mystic Seaport? Where does it arrive?
No, we rented a warehouse and a little warehouse. It was actually in an old grain mill near my home. And the owner of the building, my landlord, he just really liked Rodolfo and I. So I can remember when the first distributor came to pick up the product. We loaded the truck and he said, okay, where's the bill of lading? And I'm like, bill of lading? What's a bill of lading? So I ran to the landlord and I'm like, Frank, what's a bill of lading? He said, I'll help you. I mean, we had to learn we didn't know anything.
How did you even, you have all this product coming, and then what did you guys do? Did you start to go around to grocery stores and say, hey, we've got this pasta, will you carry it? How did you even, because ordering the pasta from that company and the sauces is the easy part.
Yes. And my husband couldn't speak English, and I'm a terrible seller. So basically—
Perfect.
Exactly.
Combination.
Yeah. So there was a gourmet shop in town, and I kind of clicked with the manager there. She took some. And, I mean, eventually I figured out you need a broker and things like that.
And I guess you also presumably started to work with a small distributor there. Where were they placing your products?
Well, it was basically in the Northeast, and this distributor called Associated Buyers actually started selling our products to food co-ops. Mm. So there's like a national network of food co-ops. Then it was all independent, but the food co-ops really embraced this whole wheat pasta, and that's how we really got started.
So it was whole wheat pasta, and what else were you guys selling?
I think we had some jellies, some juices, fruit nectars.
Like jams, like sweet jellies?
Yeah. Yeah, olive oil.
And all under this label, BioNature.
Yes.
And at the time, was it you and Rodolfo and your brother living together?
Yes. And he would go to work and put money on the table because we couldn't get a paycheck. And I would cook for us.
So there's the three of you living in an apartment, and I mean, you were putting money, you were spending money to buy this product, right? But you had to make money from the product. And was it hard? Was it easy? How does it work? Like, you import the stuff, I mean, you buy something for a dollar, you sell it for $1.50, right? It's a pretty simple principle, but was that more or less what you were doing?
It's what we were trying to do. I mean, we also had to pay for trade shows and expenses. We submitted the BioNature brand for the fancy food show. I think it's called the Sophie Award. And we actually won as best new product line.
Where's that food show?
In New York. Mm-hmm. And so that's where all the money went. You know, it was like those added expenses.
But still, I mean, it's still hard to, I mean, anyone knows, anyone who's introducing a brand knows how hard it is, especially with no marketing budget, to get people to use it or to try it. I have to imagine even in the first few years, it was still a tiny number of people had even heard of it.
I think we managed to sell about $500,000 the first year.
That's not bad.
And at the end of the year, I was really behind in the QuickBooks and putting things into the computers, but it was the end of the year. So I had put all the bills and all the expenses, and I ran our first P&L, and it was like negative 200.
Because of the cost that you were, the amount of money you were spending on buying product and also going to trade shows and other expenses?
Yes. And I couldn't lose my brother's money. So I was in my office, this little office we had. I put two chairs together. I laid down and I just said, please, I promise that I will be a good employer. I'll share my profits with my employees. I'll always do right by my customers. Just please help me not lose this money.
Who are you talking to?
Whatever higher power would listen to me.
When we come back in just a moment, how Carla and Rodolfo built BioNature into a top organic brand and then almost lost control of the business, and how that near disaster led to the launch of Jovial. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to How I Built This from NPR. Hey, welcome back to How I Built This from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. So it's the late 1990s, and Carla and Rodolfo are trying to get BioNature's pastas and jams and olive oil into small food co-ops across the country. And they're also trying not to lose all their money in the process. And then
a major organic food distributor called us and told us they wanted to carry our products.
How did they find out about you?
These food co-ops requested that they pick up the product.
Wow.
Yeah, wow. And so basically, if you can get your product in enough retail stores, the retail stores can request that the distributor carries your product. And that's what happened to us. And once that distributor carried our products, a food broker called us and asked if they could represent us. And then things just started to take off.
And the idea would be that people who are looking for more sort of whole grain, wholesome pastas would just discover it on the shelves.
Yes. And a lot of people started to buy the semolina pasta because we pressed it with bronze dyes. It was made in an old pasta. I mean, it was really good quality.
Because bronze and bronze dyes, that's what makes pasta have that like those like microscopic ridges in them, right, that holds the sauce.
Yes. Otherwise, it just slides. The sauce will slide right off.
It just slides off.
Yes. And I organized my company in a way that we were able to market the product.
What did you do? How did you do? Tell me some of the things that you remember doing to market the product.
Well, basically, when you start to sell the product, there's all of these, you know, sales and promotions that you have to do. And we were getting charged back so much money, it was becoming hard to make money.
And when you say chargeback, you were having to pay the supermarkets the money that you essentially were discounting to the customers, right?
Yes.
Yeah. That's actually how it works. Like when there's a discount at the supermarket's not giving you a discount. It's the brand. And then they still have to pay the supermarket the full price that
yes.
it normally would retail for.
And if you don't have a way to control that, they can just – it just becomes unreasonable.
And it can completely destroy business.
Yes, because you don't want to say no, but you have to sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, you have to be in charge of how you're spending your money.
So must have been times where you were selling the pastas for less than you were paying for them or around the same price.
It was tough. Let's just say it was tough.
So part of it was just discounts. And then what other kind of marketing were you doing?
Well, to believe it or not, I actually answered customer service emails for like 5 years and really connected with our customers. And I think, I don't know, I personally felt like it made a difference. You know, I would just if we made a mistake, I would say, yeah, we made a mistake. I'm sorry. Or I would give them a glimpse of the education I had on food. And they were like, oh my God, this is the best customer service I've ever gotten.
But what explains the fact that people were finding out about it? I mean, it's one brand of pasta on a shelf of 40 brands of pasta. What explains the fact that people found out about it? I mean, I'm assuming you weren't advertising on television or in magazines. You weren't on Oprah. No. What was it?
Well, there is a large organic trade show in California called the Natural Products Expo West.
Yeah, in Anaheim, famous
yes.
one.
Yes. Yeah. And we had begged this manufacturer to make the first organic balsamic vinegar on the market. And we went to the trade show and we exhibited these products. And at a certain point, this guy came by and he was from Spectrum Organics and he was the founder, CEO. And he said, I'm going to send a friend of mine, you know, a guy that works at our company by to talk to you about this organic balsamic vinegar. So his president, Neil, came by and said, you know, we'd really like to partner with you on this product and sell it under the Spectrum brand. So he came to Italy and we visited the factory and then...
Well, you made an agreement with him? You said, sure, we're happy to do it.
Yes,
With the balsamic vinegar.
Yeah,
okay.
Sure.
Yeah.
So he came to Italy and we rented this minivan. We just randomly drove around Italy and stopped wherever we felt like stopping. Hmm. And his wife and him were kind of bickering in the car. So I said, hey, let's switch places. So she sat in front with Rodolfo and they got along so well. And I sat next to him. And at a certain point, I turned to him and I said, Neil, I really need to find a sales guy. And he said, somebody called me the other day. I think he'd be perfect for you. Let me get his name and I'll give it to you. So when we got home to Connecticut, I called this guy and basically I sent him a package and our price list and I said, I really need help with these chargebacks.
What did you send him? You sent him pasta and what else?
I think we had tomatoes at that time and olive oil and everything.
Right.
And the next day I got a letter from him and he said, I love your line. I want to work for you.
Wow.
He had a lot of experience and he really helped us grow the brand. Hmm. And so it took, I'm not sure how many years, but BioNature became the number one organic selling pasta in the United States.
Let's just be clear about that for a sec. That sounds great. Sounds amazing. It's a huge achievement. But I have to imagine, by the time it became the number one organic pasta brand in the U.S., let's say in the early 2000s, that's a tiny sliver of the pasta market, right? I mean, it's teeny tiny sliver.
I've always been humble, so I never was like, oh my God, I'm so great. You know, I'm the number one pasta. But
right.
The people in Italy, you know, the success really went to their heads, and they were the total opposites of us.
They were excited about how well the product was doing in the U.S. It was doing better in the U.S. than it was in Italy?
Much better.
Because in the U.S., this was something interesting, organic Italian pasta, whereas in Italy, it was just pasta.
Yes.
But did it occur to you at that point, like maybe we should be doing our own thing, or were you just perfectly happy kind of being the BioNature outpost in the U.S.?
I was trusting, and we actually didn't even have a contract, which is crazy. And at that point, things were getting a little – I noticed that these guys were – you know, they had brought on partner investors.
The Italian owners of the BioNature
yes.
brand, okay.
And they opened a new factory, and it was beautiful. But I was like, how are they going to pay for this thing? You know, I was sensing that there were signs that – they were overspending.
So what happened? I mean, did BioNature, let's just say they were going to go out of business, that would obviously affect you guys because you would not have a product to sell in the U.S.
We would have lost everything. I mean, and I knew that. And at the same time, BioNature weren't getting along with their partners. So they were interested in a distribution agreement, but also a licensing agreement that we could start if we wanted to, because they figured if things went bad with their partners, we could take control of the brand and they would get a royalty payment.
And were you guys at that point, because now this is around, I think, 2008 and the financial crisis is hitting. I mean, was your business doing really well? Were you guys financially secure and all those things?
I think we were surviving. I mean, we were about maybe $15 million in sales, and things were okay.
But you had, I mean, you weren't banking $15 million bucks a year, right? I mean,
No. You know, I have an accountant who's been my financial advisor from day one, and I walked in, I told him my story, and he looked at me and he said, "Carla, you're really bright. I think you're going to be successful, but you're going to have to accept that you're not going to be able to take money out of this company. You're just going to have to keep reinvesting your profits every year." And that's what I did.
So when this company, BioNature, started to come apart, and you guys very wisely made an agreement with them that if it did fall apart, you would continue to have the license and pay them a royalty, that must have been really stressful, because you had invested at this point 10 years more in this business.
Yes, it was hard time for my family. My kids were 6 and 3, and my older daughter was always like, "Why do you have that face, Mom?" I'm like, "Oh, just thinking about work, you know," or, "What are those bad people doing?" You know, they didn't understand, but it was evident that we were in big trouble.
And you, at the time, even though you had a house in Connecticut, you decided that you wanted to move back to Italy and live in Italy, right?
Well, we just had finished a house, which I had bought by the skin of my teeth. And we packed up our bags and went to Italy, because now we had to find people to make the products right away, because we were there was no more factory.
Wow.
So we went there and found new factories and suddenly realized that the pricing that we had was very unfair. And so when we went direct, we made a lot more money.
Because the price that they were selling it to you was actually
totally unfair.
Yeah.
Totally unfair.
So I guess at this point, Carla, I should explain kind of a complex situation that you kind of found yourself in. Because from what I understand, BioNature, right, they were having problems. Some of the owners of BioNature made a deal with another group of Italian business owners to allow them to license their products in the U.S., basically trying to cut you guys out, even though you and Rodolfo had built up the brand in the U.S., and so you guys filed a lawsuit.
Yes.
And I mean, anybody listening to this knows that a lawsuit is super stressful and takes a long time.
It took years, and it was very expensive, and I did actually hire a top lawyer because I didn't want to lose. Because I didn't even not want to lose, because the licensing part was a no-brainer.
Yeah.
I wanted to prove that they had held us back and caused us to lose a lot of profits so that we could actually buy the brand.
You need to just buy them out. Because what was the point of promoting the brand in the U.S. and all the work you had done for the previous 12 years if you didn't have some ownership?
Exactly.
God, I cannot believe you worked with them without a contract for almost 10 years.
Anyone who's listening, do not do that.
Yes. Right, because you were basically, I mean, they had a great deal, right? And again, I mean, it sounds like there was a friendship. You had met these people, you liked them, they liked you, and then you were promoting their brand. It's like if I started a kombucha company called Guys Kombucha and I found some young French college students, I was like, "Yep, you guys go promote it and I'll sell it to you and you guys can get a cut of it in France." And then they just spend the next 10 years promoting Guy's Kombucha in France. Like, I've got a great brand in France. I mean, that's basically what they had.
BioNature,
yeah.
Like I said, I really had no idea what I was doing. And I didn't really have any qualifications to even ask. You know, I felt like I couldn't even ask for a contract in the beginning. And then by the time I didn't, we were so busy working, I never really crossed my mind.
So, all right. So now you've got this lawsuit, which is super stressful, and you have to run the company, and you've got two kids, and they're in school in Italy. How are you doing all that stuff?
It's a very difficult time in my life. And, you know, just the children, you know, my daughter was like, "Where's my yellow house? Where are my toys?"
Yeah.
And renting an apartment and just buying everything all over again. It was tough.
So I imagine at this point, you are dealing with a lawsuit, you're dealing with this stress of a potential competitor distributing your brand in the U.S. And at this point, you don't yet own the brand. Today, you do own it. But at that time, you did not own the brand, BioNature.
Right.
Did you start to think, I got to get some control over something? Because there was a possibility that you would not win that lawsuit, and then BioNature would be out of your hands.
Yeah. We would talk about it all the time. Do we switch the brand out? You know, we didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
And one day I said, I'm going to start a new brand. I told everybody in our company and they said, you're crazy.
Because you'd already spent all this time building up the brand BioNature.
Yeah. But I said, I'm really the one who built the BioNature brand. I can do it again. And I learned a lot in my life. I think I was 40 when I started Jovial. And someone had said to me, oh, it's your 40th birthday. Think of what you want to accomplish. So I thought about it and I thought, you know, I want to do something that really comes from within.
Did you come to the realization when you started Jovial, or when you were about to start Jovial, that you had to do this? That relying only on BioNature was too actually quite dangerous? That in order to actually do something that was less dangerous, it's almost like you had to start Jovial.
I had to. I mean, I had no choice. I wasn't going to switch out the brand. It was just too weird. I mean, I had to start over. And I really wanted to do something that I had created because I knew that I was a big part of the BioNature success. And even though those products, a few of the products were lined up before I got into it, I feel like I improved them later and that I'm good at what I do.
So you're starting to think about a brand. Meantime, one of your kids has some serious health problems, right? Is this Julia, your older daughter?
Julia, my oldest daughter.
What's going on with her at the time?
She had food sensitivity since she was born. Mm. It just kept getting progressively worse to the point where she had a lot of symptoms and just looked very unwell.
If you don't mind me asking, what kind of symptoms?
Not at all. She had stomach discomfort. She had swollen lymph nodes. She had huge tonsils, her nose were plugged, she'd often get bronchitis, and then she developed asthma, and then her hair started to fall out in clumps.
I mean, and how old was she?
She was 7.
This started to happen with more frequency when you were in Italy?
Yes, because we got here and we were living with my mother-in-law, and it was all, you know, bread, pasta. Yeah, and literally after 2 weeks, she had a severe asthma attack.
So I'm assuming you went to the doctor to find out what's going on.
We did. They tested her for celiac disease because that's pretty prominent here in Italy. And
celiac,
it came back negative.
I did not know celiac is prominent in Italy.
Italy loves people with food, and they regard celiac disease as a serious disease. So, you know, people are trained in restaurants, certified. Huh. They just have a complete respect. Like, if you can't eat wheat, they feel bad for you. They don't feel like, oh, yeah, sure, you know?
Wow. So she came back from a celiac test, and she was negative. So that means that she was not allergic to gluten, but it didn't mean that gluten wasn't maybe connected to some of her health issues.
Right. There is a famous homeopathic doctor in my town. So we got her in there, and he looked her over, and he said, I believe she has gluten sensitivity. It's not celiac disease. But if she stops eating wheat, I think all of her symptoms will go away.
So you go on a gluten-free diet, right? You stop eating. And let's be honest, gluten-free bread, I'm sure there's some great, and I know people are going to be listening and they're going to start sending me loaves of gluten-free bread. But I haven't found one that is good as not gluten-free bread. Let's just be honest.
Regular bread.
It's not great. It's really hard. And so, but in the meantime, this is, from what I understand, this is like 2007, 2008. You come across a variety of wheat called einkorn.
Yes.
How did you come across einkorn? Were you searching for like an alternative wheat to try for your daughter?
Well, you have to know that I'm a food manufacturer, so I educate myself in food. So when the doctor said she can't eat wheat, I immediately started to research wheat. And I read about things that had happened to wheat and how it was hybridized, and then how in the 1940s there was the Green Revolution where they were breeding it to increase yields, and how they had dwarfed it with cobalt radiation. And I was like, oh my God, no wonder why my daughter can't digest this wheat.
And you're thinking, what? Maybe I can find wheat that's not hybridized?
Yeah, maybe I can find the oldest wheat that there is. So my husband is really our research and development. I was like, find something, please. Because when I see somebody who's not well, I don't believe it's their fault. I feel like there's something wrong with what they're eating. And, you know, it became my daughter. So I was never going to stop till I figured out what to do. And I told my husband, find the oldest wheat that there is in existence and let's try it.
When we come back in just a moment, how Carla helped bring einkorn out of the shadows and onto the shelves of stores, and how she began to market Joviol with one of the most labor-intensive ideas you can think of, inviting a bunch of people to a cooking retreat in Tuscany. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to How I Built This from NPR. Hey, welcome back to How I Built This. I'm Guy Raz. So it's around 2009, and Carla and Rodolfo are talking about starting a new pasta brand. And they're also starting to learn about an ancient form of wheat called einkorn.
So we looked up the story of einkorn being found frozen in the stomach of Atsi the Iceman, the frozen mummy that was found in the Alps.
Yeah.
There's a museum here. We immediately went to the museum with our kids, and there was a couple of grains that were frozen on his coat that looked exactly like a wheat berry from today. It was amazing. And we found an association in northern Italy that after he had been discovered, they got grants from the European Union to figure out everything they could about einkorn. And with a local farmer, they started to replenish these einkorn seeds.
Wow. So, okay, a couple questions. First of all, it sounds like a German name, einkorn.
It is. It means one grain because there's only one grain attached to the stalk at a time. It looks different than regular wheat.
So basically, this wheat was thought to have been extinct and was resurrected?
Yeah, there's a couple hundred acres, some in France, some in Germany, you know, Turkey, where people still grow it.
You come across this grain, and what did you do? Was it available? Could you just buy a bunch of it and mill it into flour?
No. So we made an appointment with this researcher. We listened to the whole story, which was fascinating to me, the nutrition, the versatility. You know, I was like, oh my God. So at the end of the meeting, I said, I believe that I can sell this product in the United States. Can you give us seeds?
But how did you know? I mean, even though it was less hybridized, you thought, wait, this might be a way to get people who are not celiac but still gluten sensitive to still enjoy wheat because this is an heirloom, pure, non-hybridized wheat.
It's more than heirloom. It's ancient, the most ancient grain that there is. So nobody touched it. It's pure. But I run my business by intuition. You know, my head said, go for it, and I did.
So how did you get your hands on it to start experimenting? Because you're a baker, you're a cook.
Yeah, so I found a little mill that had some in northern Italy, and I got some, and then I put Julia on this clinical trial, basically. She either ate a meal with einkorn for lunch, and then a gluten-free. We switched back and forth.
What were you making? Einkorn what?
I started to make bread. And, you know, cookies and whatever, anything, everything.
And was it harder to work? I mean, is einkorn flour, does it work the same way? Was it easy to kind of work with and turn it into a nice bread loaf?
It wasn't. My kids still talk about the first loaves were like bricks because basically it absorbs less water than wheat. So I would keep adding flour to make it feel like the texture of regular, because I already knew how to make sourdough.
Yeah.
And then when I would bake it, it wouldn't rise, and it was terrible. And then this one week, we went on vacation, and I took the flour and the starter, and there was nothing in this kitchen that we were in. So I mixed up the dough, and it was really late, and I was tired. And so I just decided to add more water. And then the next day I kind of plopped it in this pan and, oh my God, the best bread came out of the oven. I was like, that's the trick.
So you had a wet dough to throw into the pot. And
I didn't add as, it's still way less water than a regular loaf of bread, but it was right. enough to get the bread to rise well.
And you didn't need it, basically.
No, it was kind of like a no-need bread.
A no-need bread, I gotcha. And this flour was, I mean, it's still wheat, right? But it's different because what? It was like it's higher in protein content?
It has a very weak gluten. So there are certain types of glutens or proteins in all other kinds of wheat that Einkorn does not have.
So like pizza made in Naples, is they use like 00 flour, like that has a very yeah. high gluten.
Yeah, it's chewy. That's where you get
chewy,
the chewiness.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. But you can still make delicious pizza and everything with Einkorn. You just have to learn how to do it.
And Einkorn, to be clear, is not gluten-free. We should make
it is not gluten-free. Yeah. You can't eat it if you have celiac disease.
Right. Okay, so you start experimenting with this, and you're making Einkorn everything, like Einkorn bread and pastas and pies and stuff like that for Julia. And what happens? Do her symptoms go away?
She started to feel better in about 2 months. And then progressively better. It took about 2 years for everything to go away.
All right. So now you know that you have something that you want to develop into a brand. But who's growing Einkorn? Where do you get it?
Well, so basically I asked this researcher if I could have seeds. And he gave us the name of a farmer. And he said, we don't sell seeds. But if this guy's willing to share with you, go for it. So everybody likes my husband. He drove to the farm. They became friends. The guy said, okay, I'll give you the seeds. And then that weekend, we had a school end-of-the-year dinner. We sat across from this guy. We started talking. He said he was a wheat farmer. And I was like, hey, you interested in trying something new? And he said, sure, I'm not making any money growing wheat.
Talk about, so wait, just for a moment, just talk about a moment of luck here. It's an elementary school dinner, and the guy you're talking to is a wheat farmer. And you happen to have a wheat problem that you need solved. And how often do we get to just sit across the table from a wheat farmer who we randomly meet?
It just fell into my lap.
Yeah.
And he wasn't only a wheat farmer. He was like the best wheat farmer I've ever met because he was going to grow that wheat no matter what. I mean, we had no idea how many seeds you planted per acre. Like, we didn't know anything. And I think we planted 50 acres the first year. And I love this farmer because he would come – in Italy, you can pick your children up for lunch at elementary school. He would come in a gigantic tractor to pick up his daughter for school, and I would be like, there's my farmer. And he would just every once in a while say, you guys got to come to the farm because I've never seen anything like it. It's like totally different. I don't know if it's going to make it. And it did, and we harvested it.
And from what I understand, by the way, from reading about this – the yield is like a fifth of the normal yield for wheat. So like you might have 50 acres of this, but like it's a fifth less than you would get from hybridized normal wheat that most of us eat.
It's nothing. And we've had to save the seeds every year. We started with this original variety, which will never change. So we've had to manage everything. It's, you know, it's a huge project.
All right. Meantime, you decide to start a new brand called Jovial. You're going to continue to distribute BioNature in the U.S., but you're going to start this new brand, Jovial. And Jovial was going to be built around Einkorn and gluten-free pastas?
Yes. A lot of advisors said, don't do anything but Einkorn. You're the Einkorn person. And I'm like, it's going to take years.
To get people to know what it is, yeah.
I can't do that. I need to come up with, something else.
Yeah. Yeah. So you started, when you started out with Jovial, you didn't just start with the Einkorn pasta, but you also had like rice pastas, like full on gluten free pastas.
Yes. I didn't want my daughter to be eating a ton of starch and gums for the rest of her life.
Yeah.
I wanted to just be flour. So I've always tried to make gluten free foods without those added ingredients. So the pasta factory that makes our pasta actually started making gluten-free pasta in 1970. It was a no-protein pasta for people with kidney disease, and they tweaked a machine, and they got in on the gluten-free pasta really early, and they're really good at it. So I said, let's pull out all the stops, Brown's dyes, slow drying, everything. And, you know, who's going to do that for, like, who really cares about gluten-free people? Well, I did. I wanted a good pasta. Yeah. Yeah.
You wanted the bronze, because that's more expensive, right? Because the most pasta we eat in the U.S., even probably even in Italy, is just mass produced, and it's not extruded through bronze dyes that leave those, that like nice textured pasta. If you want to buy it, you can go and buy it. It's just more expensive.
Yeah, they use Teflon, so it's like a nonstick pan. It just slides right through.
But you wanted gluten-free pasta to have that texture to hold the sauce.
I wanted the gluten-free pasta to be as close to regular pasta as I could possibly make it.
And what did you start with? You started with rice.
Brown rice.
Brown rice. Okay, you start with brown rice.
You know, you need the brown rice to get it a little bit more flavor, to be closer to wheat flavor.
Got it. Okay. So I think in 2010, Jovial was born, and now you've already had this distribution network because through BioNature. So I have to imagine it wasn't that hard to get your products into Whole Foods and to other health food stores, right? Were you able to get the einkorn pasta into Whole Foods pretty quickly?
We did. They took it nationally, and it was actually not too hard to get the products into distribution. But unfortunately, they did not sell.
They didn't sell.
People didn't know the brand. And I was surprised by that. I was surprised.
Because you thought consumers are like me. They're going to look at the labels. They're going to see there's high protein content. They're going to see there's a high fiber content. They're going to want to try this. But people are not like you. They don't do that in the grocery store.
They walk by things a couple of times before they pick it up.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Americans are, you know, they're faithful to their brand. So once you get them on your side, it's good. But it's hard to get them to stop buying whatever they're buying and try something new.
So it did not do well.
I think it took 6 months for Einkorn to be off the shelf, but they kept the other products.
What were the other? Oh, the brown rice pasta.
The brown rice pasta. Yeah.
So they dropped Einkorn pasta, and that must have been kind of a gut punch.
It was, but we also had a lot of people that were embracing the flour. They wanted to bake at home with something that they felt was pure. So it was this product that we were growing in a different way than our usual channels.
So you were selling Einkorn flour, like all-purpose flour, at Whole Foods?
No, we were selling it direct.
Direct to consumers?
Yeah, and a lot of people, just the word started just spreading. Yeah.
Meantime, you're not getting traction with the Einkorn pasta at Whole Foods. Pretty soon after Whole Foods dropped you, from what I understand, you decided to offer like cooking retreats in Tuscany, like for people to come to learn how to cook with Einkorn flour. You started to like host people and teach them how to do this, right?
Yes.
And the idea was that if you could just get people to see and to hear the story, then more people would know about it and it would take off.
Sometimes I would sit with marketing and I would tell them stories and they were like, oh, if people could just hear this, they would buy our product. So I started to think about it, and I said, I'm going to try this. So I think the first two times, I had no idea how this would go. So I wasn't going to teach the classes. I paid an influencer who was popular and gluten-free to come and do it. Mm-hmm. But she also promoted the trip, and that's how people came, because they didn't really know us too well.
This is a food blogger who was influential in the gluten-free world, and you said, hey, come, and we want to show you what we do.
Yes. She was called Gluten Free Girl at the time. Mm. And basically, we all live in the same big villa, which is beautiful. And it's a few steps from the pasta factory. So I would invite, you know, important buyers or, you know, people also in the industry to come and take them on a tour of the pasta factory. Then we would have a class every other day, free time in between. And after class, we would make a traditional Italian dinner that everybody loved. But when we first started, I worked so hard. I'd wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning to have breakfast ready by 7 because everything was fresh. I wouldn't sit down until midnight. I mean, I basically would sleep for 4 hours. And this is like manual labor. You're like cooking. But we learned how to get better at it. And I just learned that I feel like I have a gift for this type of teaching. I know a lot about food. So when we're in the cooking class, their eyes are just on me. You know, they love it.
I'm just wondering, Carla, from a marketing perspective, I mean, you were really busy. You're running BioNature, you're starting this new brand, Joviol, and you need to get the word out about Einkorn. Like, it doesn't seem super efficient to start a food retreat and to spend your free time, which probably had almost none, teaching just 20 people at a time how to cook with Einkorn. It doesn't seem like a particularly efficient way to market your product.
But just think of all the people that would see that on social media and want to go but not be able to go.
Yeah.
And I've always wanted my business to be my own. You know, I want to do what I'm good at. Like, staying true to yourself is the best thing that you can do in a business. I don't copy people. I just do what I feel like is important, is true to me. And that was something that I have that's unique. And once I started doing the getaways, I would hear people talking about everything. I got to know the gluten-free consumer up close and personal and understand what was missing in their lives. And I also connected with them on a deep level. And I've had people come back 6 times.
Yeah. It's amazing to me that you decided to do this, which turned out to be smart because it was a way to get the word out about the food. But, like, this is not – I mean, when you look at, like, your P&L, right, for your business, this is not a money generator. You can go on these retreats now and they're – you know, they're not bargain basement cheap, but I can't imagine you guys are really making money off of these things.
We try to break even. My business has never been about money. Mm-hmm. If you looked at the margins on Einkorn, they never would have happened unless I was crazy. But I always felt like, you know, that first promise, like, I am going to honor my consumer. If I did that, the money would follow.
When did you guys first be, I mean, you started this business with your brother is a partner, 96 or something. When did you become profitable?
I think we were profitable after the third year. Not immensely profitable.
Yeah,
and I think
we
had 2 years where we lost money, but we've run a tight ship. I mean, we had a very small warehouse that we rented for $3,000 a month for until 2014. And we stretched that space. We outgrew that 7 years before we moved out.
I think that in maybe 2012 or 2013, I think America's Test Kitchen named your gluten-free pasta, the brown rice pasta, the best in the U.S., which I have to imagine just, like, was a huge boost for your business, for the Joviol brand.
They actually did it a couple years in a row, and they marketed that a lot, and it really did. It was a turning point for our pasta.
And that really, did the gluten-free pasta really begin to drive the Joviol brand? Was that the engine that kind of helped it take off?
Yes, and it totally does today, too. It's our best-selling product.
So as you started to gain more traction through the gluten-free pasta, did you start to see more traction through the Einkorn pastas?
Yeah, I think we did. We introduced tomatoes, Einkorn crackers, cookies. And then because I have this passion for products packed in glass, we also came up with beans. And last year, we introduced a grain-free pasta, which has taken off like you can't even believe.
Cassava pasta.
Yes, because I feel like if I can create a food that can make a difference in somebody's life and fill a void and do it well, then that's what I have to do. So grain-free was becoming popular, and I felt like I could do this well with no added ingredients, nothing, just cassava and water. And that product has taken off way faster than brown rice pasta. It's really, really doing well.
So now the brand, Joviol, you're still based in Connecticut, right? It's the headquarters are in Connecticut.
Yes. We have a warehouse and an office.
But you make all of your things in it. All your products are made in Italy. Most of your products are made in Italy, right?
Everything is currently made in Italy, but we do have about 5 years of new products. And some of these products will have to be made in the United States because they're not products that we can make in Italy. So I'm very excited to, you know, I'll finally have a product that's made in the USA, which I'm proud of.
We should mention, by the way, you did win that lawsuit eventually, and you did were able to buy out the BioNature brand, and it is now yours. You own that brand.
Yes.
When did Joviol kind of begin to become a bigger brand than BioNature, if it is.
It is.
When did you start to notice Joviol kind of overshadowing BioNature as a brand?
2019. Yes.
You know, so many companies so many businesses that we've had on the show, the founders, some of the businesses are totally privately owned or founder owned. Some of them got to a point where they could not actually scale without outside money. Like, because a Walmart or a Target said, we need your product. And it meant that they had to, like, quadruple output. And cash flow alone could not fund that or finance that. How would you deal with that?
I don't spend money unless I have it. So if I want to do a project, I make sure that we make the money that we need to cover it. Because you can choose what supermarkets or chains or whatever you present to. You don't have to say yes to everybody. That's how we do it. We have an order of priorities and work down that list. I don't need to double my sales. I don't need to sell 200. I mean, if I do, that's great, but it's got to happen in a manageable way. And when I hired our new sales guy, I told him, you know, you might be able to totally go over, you know, the sales goals that I'm going to give you, but I don't want to grow faster than that. I don't want to put myself in a position where I'd need to ask for money.
Over the years, I mean, I have to imagine that you've been approached by people who want to invest and want to kind of scale this and make this into, like, the, you know, the Barilla Pasta of organics and, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And is that attractive to you? Is there anything about, I mean, is that an interesting thought to turn Joviol into, like, the Barilla of organics?
Absolutely not. I mean, I have worked so hard, I can't even tell you, to stay independently owned. And I just want to keep continuing to be privately owned and be able to hand this down to my children.
Yeah. What would happen? I mean, I've asked this question to Gary Erickson, Kit Crawford, the owners of Clif Bar, because they started it.
Yes.
They own it. And, you know, I've asked him the similar question. What happens if your kids don't want to run this company one day?
Well, we've talked about it recently, actually, and I believe they do. They might not run it from day to day, but they are totally against selling our company. So I've kind of set up a management team last year because it got too hard for me. I couldn't do everything anymore. And I feel like we're growing the infrastructure and everything could run smoothly and they could live happily ever after. But here's my daughter. She actually developed a product that I think is really going to be successful, and we're trying to get it produced. So,
is it come in a jar or does it come in a box?
It's actually a bread product.
Oh, interesting. So maybe it comes in the freezer section.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Maybe. Maybe. I think you'll like it. Yeah.
I think so. And by the way, what role does Rodolfo play with the company now?
He manages every factory except for the pasta factory. And he manages the farmers and he manages research and development. He also taught me a lot. You know, we've worked together from day one and he's a totally different personality than me. So there is this Italian side to the business. And if I was the only person here, we never would have succeeded because he's more just very humble, sweet man. He's just nice and kind and he has patience. And he also had a different approach to running a business. Like when we first started to hire people, he couldn't believe that people had to pay for health insurance. So from day one, I've always paid 100% of every employee's health insurance and covered every expense because we have this European kind of sensibility to things like that. So he's taught me a lot. I mean, he taught me a lot about food. He's kind of a behind-the-scenes, quiet person who really has made a difference.
When you think about all of the struggle that you went through, you know, starting the Piadini place and Mystic and then shutting it down and going back and forth to Italy and then back to America and back to Italy and then, you know, and all that, just an incredible tragedy. I mean, your father, your mother, Rodolfo's brothers and then the lawsuits and the, I mean, just there's a lot of struggle there. I don't know. when you think about that, do you think, yep, it's just, that's just part of the journey? Or do you think, God, that's kind of crazy. I don't know how I made it through.
I think both. Sometimes I think I've had a full life. I mean, I've lived not every experience, but I've lived a lot of experiences. And sometimes my husband and I talk about it, like, how did all this happen to us? But I think most people have tragedies. We've had a lot of them, but I think it's shaped our lives and it's really made me more sensitive to helping others.
When you think about your journey and what happened and where you are now, how much do you attribute that to your hard work and how much do you attribute that to just luck?
Well, I was lucky to get into the health food industry early. And I've definitely worked very, very hard. But I've had this very strong intuition or inner voice that has really guided me through, and I've listened to it. And I think that has been important.
That's Carla Bartolucci, co-founder of Jovial Foods. On May 22nd, Carla passed away unexpectedly after a brief illness. Carla's husband, Rodolfo, will continue in his role at Jovial. And this month, their daughter, Julia, who was the inspiration for the brand, will be officially joining Jovial to help run the family business. Thanks so much for listening to the show this week. If you're not yet a subscriber, please do subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to write to us, our email address is hibt@npr.org. And if you want to follow us on Twitter, we're @GuyRaz or @HowIBuiltThis. You can also find us on Instagram. That's @HowIBuiltThisNPR or my personal account, @Guy.Raz. This episode was produced by J.C. Howard with music composed by Ramtin Arablouei. It was edited by Neva Grant with research help from Dareth Gales. Our audio engineer was Patrick Boyd. Our production staff includes Casey Herman, Rachel Faulkner, James Delahousie, Julia Carney, Farah Safari, Liz Metzger, Janet Ujung Lee, and Annalise Ober. Our intern is Harrison Vijay Choi. And Jeff Rogers is our executive producer. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to How I Built This. This is NPR. If you like How I Built This, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.